Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
This is CBS
Eye on Veterans.
Eye on Veterans.
Here's retired Marine Captain Chaz Henry.
Politics and people who've served in the military. Jeremy Tigan is a political science professor at New Jersey's Ramapo College. He's also an Air Force veteran, and that played a role in his decision to spend a lot of time studying how voters perceive vets running for political office and whether having worn the uniform offers veteran candidates a particular advantage when voters make their choices at the polls.
It started a very long time ago when I was a very young man enlisted in the U.S. Air Force, voting in my first presidential election with an absentee ballot in the 1992 presidential election. And without disclosing my own preferences, all the airmen around me were livid to the point of almost anger at the fact that Bill Clinton had, you know, somehow avoided military service, and they thought that presidential candidates should be quote unquote real veterans. And I guess I stored that away as a sort of empirical question of, you know, what is this relationship between military service and elected office, and why do we? Why are so many of our elected officials, why do so many have military experiences, is something I sort of tucked away. And then later, after I, started actually studying political science, I kind of came back to the topic and had a very enjoyable experience sort of looking into the 70 some men and one woman who've been major party nominees running for president of the United States, and looking into their military experiences and how they played out on the campaign trail.
Now, at different times in U.S. history, there have been more people in the military, sometimes less. And so that, of course, has to have influenced the number of veterans potentially available to run for office. Have you noticed any trending in veterans being more likely to run, less likely?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you've hit one of the biggest sort of causal influences that drives how many military veterans enter elected office, or at least attempting to, is that it's just a question of how many veterans we have in the population at any given time. I mean, compare a couple examples. You know, after World War II, we asked almost three quarters of a generation to serve in uniform during the 1940s. So it shouldn't be terribly surprising that virtually every nominee for both parties between, you know, Eisenhower through Bob Dole had military experience of one kind or another, whereas we shouldn't be terribly surprised that other cohorts just proportionally have fewer veterans running for office because there just weren't that many in the population.
What has been the thinking over time about the importance of understandings a person might get through military service and how that might make them a better leader?
That's another really good question. In fact, it impelled me to run an experiment where I intentionally manipulated a real congressional ad. I don't know if you know Tim Walz in Minnesota. He first ran for the Minnesota 1st District for a House race, and he put an ad on the air that was kind of biographical, and it sort of said, you know, I'm, you know, coach to the state champs, and I'm teacher of the year, and I'm, you know, Army reservist, or he's listed as military service. And so I doctored the ad so that some of the people in the experiment saw him as a military veteran, where others did not. And those that saw the Tim Walz as a military veteran overwhelmingly perceived that he was a congressional candidate that would be far better suited to handle issues of national security and defense than the Tim Walz doppelganger that did not have military service, or at least, you know, apparently did not have military service. Big differences between how individuals perceived candidates, even in a small setting of looking at a campaign ad, in the way that we see our political leaders being able to handle important issues.
So Tim Walz, a retired command sergeant major in the Minnesota National Guard, so actually did have significant and interestingly enlisted experience in the military, and now is the ranking member of the Veterans Affairs Committee in the House of Representatives. So one assumes that even among fellow legislators, they saw that here's a person whose experience could work in this specialty area on veterans issues. But is there any sort of evidence borne out beyond what voters might perceive as to a person being a better or worse public servant when it comes to dealing with national security issues after being elected?
Well, it's that point of being elected that was the sort of hypothesis that I wanted to test, which is the main reason why we have an overrepresentation, and I only mean that numerically, an overrepresentation of people with military service in circles of political power in our country, because voters like them. Like if voters are confronted with you know two candidates, one who has military service and one who doesn't, that are otherwise identical, do they prefer these military veterans? Does that explain why we have more than half of our major party nominees for president with military service, or why in the 1970s almost three quarters of Congress had military service? And the answer is no. While individual races probably have hinged on military service biographies of candidates, those are probably the exception. There's no system-wide, you know, over-encompassing advantage that veterans enjoy it in the general elections. And that seems counterintuitive to some people, especially when they look at advertisements where candidates bend over backwards to display their military service, or sometimes even exaggerate it. The intuitive inference is that, well, certainly it must get them more votes. And I guess my response to that is, if military service gave candidates, say, like a 5%, you know, boost in the polls of things being equal, well, we'd have 535 veterans in Capitol Hill, not the small number that we do today, because parties would have incentives to nominate military veterans all the time. So the advantage just simply isn't a quantitative one that you see during the general election.
No, I don't know if this would be borne out by any sort of data, but perhaps people infer that someone who has served in the military might have exhibited some form of selflessness that might be admirable.
I think so. I think that when people are confronted with candidates in the abstract, that when you ask them, especially when they're not currently running, like when let's use John McCain as an example. If you look at any other year than 2008, when he was a notable politician, you know, surveys routinely ask people's opinions about political leaders, whether they are or not running. And John McCain in the 2004 and the 2012 national election surveys enjoyed high regard and esteem, except in 2008. Once the normal partisan phrase starts to surround military candidacies, then their military biographies become a football to play with in the October through November scrum. Whereas when you ask people in the abstract, you know, they do respect and regard those with military service with a bit of a political inoculation from the usual attacks.
Interesting. So this could imply that one's veteran status is not really a decider in many cases.
You really got to have a close election for, you know, any one thing to be a decisive influence. But, I mean, look at how military service becomes, you know, salient for some people.
Political scientist and Air Force vet Jeremy Tigan, he's a professor at Ramapo College in New Jersey, and he's written a book about military veterans running for political office and what history shows about whether having done military service before throwing one's hat in the political ring gives a candidate an election boost. He says the experience of the Democratic Party presidential candidate in 2004 shows not necessarily.
You know, John Kerry's, one of his biggest assets was his military service experience. And how did he portray it on the campaign trail? Well, I mean, they made it the theme of the Democratic National Convention that year. You know, he started his acceptance speech with, you know, "I'm reporting for duty." And what happened, you know, a week later was the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth ad. When people, you know, bring their military service right into the sort of most fiery, divisive crucibles of our electoral politics, then military service becomes yet another, thing to chip candidates down with. But in the abstract, you know, I think they can fundraise with it. They can attract interest. As you mentioned earlier, with people like Tim Walz or Tulsi Gabbard or Tammy Duckworth, is they can use their military service once in office to gain visibility on issues that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do. Another example that you see of military service being used is like Robert Mueller's, you know, defenders, as this investigation unfolds, you know, frequently refer to his military service in Vietnam, even though it's not really relevant to the current day. But because, you know, he's got that asset is a way to legitimate him politically, a way to sort of put a civic halo around him.
Right. It speaks to character, one assumes, right? Or this is at least the people putting this forward hope that it will.
I think people associate military service, you know, when they're not forced to make a decision on a you know, general election ballot, I think they see military service as a heuristic, as a cue for leadership, sacrifice, patriotism, selflessness. And I might add, as somebody who's has been in the ranks white, you know, privileged professor today, it was the 4 years of my life where I was exposed to, you know, a broad economic, racial, ethnic, microcosm of America. And I think that would be, you know, a fantastic experience for, you know, those seeking to be leaders in America. So I think Americans do perceive the way that you're asking, that they do associate military service with a wide ranging of positive attributes for those seeking higher office.
So you've been working on a book having to do with veterans in elected office. Tell me the title of the book.
Sure. It's Why Veterans Run: Military Service in American Presidential Elections from 1789 to 2016. And it's published by Temple University Press.
So you've looked in, as you put this book together, you've looked at the arc of history on this topic. And what have you seen trending?
It's really the way to summarize what I found is that our broad post-war eras exhibit different patterns of military emergence that are a product of not only the size of our wars that produce, you know, smaller and larger cohorts of veterans, but a few other things that are more subtle as well. For example, the sort of state of our civil-military relations can have a big influence on how the military political interpenetration is. So even in an era when there's not a lot of veterans in the population, like the antebellum period between roughly Jackson and the Civil War, you have a very high number of military veterans running for office, but they're a very different kind of military veteran running for office compared to the post-World War II generation. In the antebellum period, you have a lot of partisan generals, people whose you know, name recognition came from being military heroes in our smaller wars, and they entered politics, you know, at the top in a lateral fashion. Whereas those that had military service after World War II, they tended to be, you know, people who were young men in the 1940s, served during World War II as young officers, served for a short amount of time, and as soon as they got out, they grabbed the lowest rungs of the political ladder and started climbing. And so different eras exhibit different patterns of veterans emergence, but altogether, each era sort of contributes to, for different reasons, a electoral system that seeks out military veterans, because more than half of the people, of the 70-some people who have run for office on a major party ballot, have had military experience.
So we've had more than a decade, going on close to two decades now, of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. What are you seeing when you look at veterans coming back from those conflicts, many of them getting very good educations using the post 9/11 GI Bill and looking to contribute? Seemingly, this generation of veterans has an ethos that's, I can't compare it to generations past, but they have an ethos of service, wanting to continue to serve. And so I'm guessing that some of them will be looking to do that in elected office.
I agree completely. It's always a risky to try to look into a crystal ball, but based on the people who are emerging from Desert Storm, Desert Shield, to sort of just kind of combine, you know, people who've served basically, you know, since the 1980s, their numbers are extremely small. You know, as you know, we rely on a very small number of our population to fight and refight very long wars, even though they're small in small intensity compared to our past conflicts. We have a very professional force that relies on people to serve in a hyper-professional way for a very long time. And so we're not producing, you know, the legions of veterans like we did after, you know, Vietnam or after World War II. Yet, despite that small number of veterans, similar numbers of them are coming and emerging in in the conversations of who's going to run in 2018, who's seeking nominations, especially in the Democratic side in this cycle. And so I expect that despite their small numbers, they will be even more overrepresented in American politics than what we've seen probably, let's say, the 20 years prior to that.
So when veterans these days gravitate toward an interest in public policy, in running for elective office, do they in large measure move toward one political party or another? And how does that compare over time?
It's always dangerous to make assumptions based on our sort of stereotypes of like military personalities, because I think a lot of people perceive that the Republican Party has sort of captured, you know, the national security and defense issue, and that, you know, and that the veteran population is overwhelmingly leans towards the Republican Party. And those things just aren't borne out by the data. Today's officer corps probably does lean more Republican, but the veteran population, you know, if you look at exit polls from recent elections, yes, they are more Republican than they leaned anywhere between 5 and 8%, you know, more Republican in exit polls. But, you know, who are veterans of this country? Well, they're older males. We already know that older individuals and males are tend to lean right. So I don't want to perpetuate a perception that only the Republican Party can enjoy success with military candidates. I think very recently you're seeing the Democratic Party, as any party does after losing a presidential election, trying to take advantage of the midterms by, you know, trying to come up with a message, trying to come up with some momentum to, you know, surge into the midterm after a presidential loss with some energy. And I think that the military veteran recruiting is one of the most visible signs of that effort.
Professor and former enlisted airman Jeremy Tigan there. His book is titled Why Veterans Run. It's a look at the long history of U.S. military vets stepping up to run for elective office. And it challenges some perceptions about the weight American voters put on veteran status when they step into voting booths to make those final decisions about who to pick.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.